Hello, and welcome back to another episode of In Summation, The Final Word. As you know, this is a program for inquisitive minds on what happens in real-world courtroom drama. I'm your host and the generator of all this chaos, Paul Townsend, back again to bring you the spookiest, scariest, Halloweeniest, and screamiest case we've ever done here. I know I have a number of listeners of this show who are now in law school. I appreciate you. By and large, that probably means you were born in the late 90s or maybe early 2000s. If that's the case, you may not remember the headlines for today's case. But for those of you, like me, born in the 80s, you may just remember hearing about this. Today's case comes out of Idaho, of all places, in the year 2006. Now, looking back at the early 2000s, for those of us who were teenagers and in our early 20s during that time, we remember things like JNCO jeans, hacky sacks, Blockbuster Video, Jonathan Taylor Thomas, etc. And like many other youths in the 90s and 2000s, I spent a lot of time going to the movies. As I pored over the documents and videos in this case, it really hit me that the early 2000s was when the horror movie genre began to kind of morph. We were no longer getting the noir horror films of Dracula or the bloodless, cerebral Alfred Hitchcock films. The end of the 70s and all through the 80s, we moved to the slasher films. For a long time, Freddy Krueger, Jason Voorhees, and Michael Myers were the holy trinity of horror villains. By the early 2000s, though, we shifted again. Movies like Saw, The Ring, Final Destination, and Hostel were utilizing new advances in technology to shed the campy feel of those 80s classics. These movies had gore, but it was the psychological mind-bending that really began to drive the genre. Horror movies had never really been known for having well-conceived plot lines, but that was changing. The new movies had plot twists, unexpected endings, and just when you thought you knew it was going to happen, things would change. As I look back, there's really one movie that kicked off this paradigm shift in the horror genre, and that was the 1996 blockbuster Scream. If you're a younger listener who enjoys horror movies but hasn't gone back and watched the original Scream, you really owe it to yourself to do so. The film really pulled horror up to competing with other types of movies. Horror movies typically didn't get big-name actors, but Scream is chock full of A-list celebrities at the time, and because of that, the acting in the movie really set it apart. I promise no spoilers here, but the concept of the movie is that the bad guy, Ghostface, so named because he wears a cheap Halloween ghost mask and an all-black cape and hood, is trying to kill Sidney Prescott, played by Neve Campbell, using a serrated hunting knife. Ghostface, for reasons we don't understand during the movie, has targeted Prescott and follows her all throughout the movie, trying to get her alone and stab her to death. Now, this is a legal podcast. We break down criminal trials, prosecution and defense arguments, judicial rulings, and jury verdicts. So why are we talking about the movie Scream? And the answer is that on September 22, 2006, a 16-year-old high school student named Cassie Jo Stoddard was house-sitting for her aunt and uncle for the weekend. Her boyfriend, Matt Beckham, initially came over after school. While they were hanging out, two other friends dropped by. They started to watch Kill Bill Volume 2, but about an hour into the movie, the two friends decided to leave to go to an actual movie theater. A little while later, the power went out in the house briefly, but then it came back on, and this ruffled Cassie a bit. She got nervous. Matt Beckham called his mother and told her that Cassie was a little frightened and asked if he could stay with her. Mrs. Beckham did not think it was appropriate for two 16-year-olds to be spending the night in an empty house together, so she said no and picked up Matt. Mrs. Beckham did offer that Cassie could stay at their place if she was concerned about being alone in the house, but Cassie said she felt responsible for taking care of the dogs and cats while house-sitting, so she decided to remain. That was Friday night. On Sunday, Cassie's aunt, uncle, and cousins returned to their home to find Cassie dead in the living room. She had been stabbed 30 times. At first, Matt Beckham was the police department's primary suspect, but in conversations with him, he casually remarked that two other friends had stopped by earlier in the evening. As the investigation unfolded, Bannock County, Idaho, was thrust to the forefront of national media. Dubbed the Scream Killers, the two friends who stopped by earlier in the night didn't just recreate the horror of the movie Scream. They filmed themselves planning it, identifying their victim. They filmed themselves apprehensive in their car outside the house. They filmed themselves talking about immediately after they fled the house. The two went to a secluded part of a park and buried their ghost face masks, black robes, knives, and the videotape. Strap in, horror fans, because this case has facts which were made for the big screen. But in the midst of it, it also presents some interesting legal questions. For instance, to what extent does just being an accomplice mitigate the harm? The two young men here were tried separately, and each admitted to being present but claimed the other was actually the one who stabbed Cassie Jo Stoddard. What was the point of making that argument? And was it even believable? And we'll take time to discuss one of the tougher aspects of being a defense attorney. Defending someone who's committed an unspeakably evil act and why it's so important for those people to have adequate representation. This is the State of Idaho versus Brian Draper and Tori Adamczyk. Bannock County, Idaho, lies on the southeastern part of the state. In the 2020 census, the population had skyrocketed to a staggering 87,018, making it the sixth most populous county in all of Idaho. It's small town rural. There are a few towns in Bannock County, but unless you live close by in Idaho, I doubt you've ever heard of them if you didn't read up on this case when it happened. We don't get a lot of cases from Idaho which capture national attention. It doesn't have any urban centers like New York, LA, Philly, Chicago, or Houston. The first thing people generally think of when you say the word Idaho is potato. It's not a hotbed of gang activity, it's not a financial center, it's not an entry point for narcotics trafficking, but it does have people, and where there are people, there is crime. And sometimes, people, even in small towns, get notions in their head to do something so depraved that it makes waves nationally. Cassie Jo Stoddard was born December 21st, 1989. She's the daughter of Anna Stoddard and was raised by Anna and her long-term partner, Victor Price. Victor and Anna had been together since 1996, approximately 10 years prior to this incident. Cassie also had a younger brother named Andrew Stoddard. The Stoddard family lived in Pocatello, Idaho, which is in Bannock County. She attended Pocatello High School. In September 2006, she was in 11th grade, a junior. She was social, popular. Cassie also had an aunt and uncle that lived nearby, Frank and Allison Contreras, who had three children of their own. Contreras has also had two dogs and three cats. And occasionally, when they went out of town, they would ask Cassie Stoddard to come and house sit for them, feeding their pets, taking the dogs out for walks so they'd get some exercise, and wouldn't generally leave the house a mess. They had asked Stoddard to house sit for them from September 22nd to 24th, 2006. The Contreras's left in the afternoon, and Cassie went to the house after school let out. It was the beginning of the school year. Cassie was dating another Pocatello High School student, also a junior, named Matthew Beckham. Beckham's family was quite fond of Stoddard. Beckham accompanied Stoddard to the Contreras' residence after school on September 22, 2006. And Stoddard had also invited over other high school friends. Brian Draper was born and spent most of his childhood in Utah. His family moved to Pocatello right before he entered high school. He grew up in the Church of Latter-day Saints and was very active up until ninth grade. That's when he fell in with a group of friends who changed his path. That's when he met Tori Adamczyk. Draper transformed from a polite, religious youth to a teenage troublemaker. He started drinking, smoking cigarettes, and shoplifting. He experimented with drugs, and he began to blur the line between fiction and reality. Tori Adamczyk, like Stoddard, was Idaho-born and raised. He was always interested in movies, as was Draper. He met Draper the freshman year of high school, and the two bonded over their interest in movies, specifically horror movies. He met Cassie in 10th grade, and they became rather good friends. Adamczyk intended to go to film school. He wanted to write and produce movies one day. Now, growing up in a small town, both Draper and Adamczyk really wanted to become famous one day. They wanted notoriety, even infamy. They wanted people to know who they were and revere them. And they really didn't care why. What was important was that people recognized their names. But when they went looking for inspiration, for something that would make them famous, they looked at someone who had achieved what they longed for, become household names despite a small town upbringing. And they settled on two individuals who really should not serve as role models for anyone, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold. Those names themselves might not be familiar, but you probably will remember them as the Columbine High School shooters from 1999. Klebold and Harris made national headlines for weeks after they mercilessly gunned down their fellow students in their Colorado high school in 1999. Draper and Adamczyk worshipped Harris and Klebold. This fascination with murder intersected with their love of slasher horror movies, and they were huge fans of the movie Scream. To Draper and Adamczyk, the Columbine High School shooters had achieved the ultimate success. They were small-town kids who became nationally famous, instantly recognizable, whose names brought fear wherever they were heard. While most people were repulsed and reviled by the horrific nature of the Columbine school shooting, Draper and Adamczyk admired it. And they decided to pair their love for slasher movies with their complete ambivalence to the value of human life. They got together and planned to murder a classmate, Cassie Jo Stoddard. Stoddard considered them friends. There's no animosity. No ill will, no resentment. There was no reason for the two to decide to murder Stoddard beyond chance and convenience. Draper and Adamczyk knew that Stoddard would be house-sitting for her Uncle Frank and Aunt Allison Contreras on the night of September 22, 2006. They knew this because, being friends with her, she had invited them over to hang out. Stoddard told Adamczyk, in addition to her boyfriend Matt Beckham, that she was house-sitting for her aunt and uncle, who had two dogs and three cats. She was going to be there for the entire weekend to take care of the pets, and that they should come by. After school, she and Beckham went to the house on Whispering Cliffs Drive. Draper and Adamczyk came in the early evening. Prior to going to the house, Draper and Adamczyk had already made the decision that they were going to kill Cassie Jo Stoddard, and possibly Matt Beckham, that night. They documented their intentions and decisions on videotape. They discussed exactly what they were planning to do and why. They discussed committing murder as though it's no different than the decision to go see a movie. They completely acknowledged that there will be no going back after they kill her. When they arrived at the Contreras house, Stoddard gave them a tour, but she didn't notice that when she showed them the basement, they unlocked an exterior door, which would allow them the ability to get back into the house later unnoticed. After the house tour, the four kids sat down and watched a portion of the movie Kill Bill Volume 2. But about an hour into the movie, Draper and Adamczyk told Stoddard and Beckham that they were going to go to the movie theater and see a movie on the big screen. So they get up and they leave. And Stoddard and Beckham finish the movie. Draper and Adamczyk do not go to the movies, however. They go back to Adamczyk's car and pull away, but not far. They don't go to the theater. They pull over to the side of the road, and they wait. And once they've worked themselves up a bit, They turn back on the videotape, and this is the exchange that's recorded. Draper. We're here in his car. The time is 9:50, September 22nd, 2006. Unfortunately, we have the grueling task of killing our two friends, and they are right in that house just down the street. Adamczyk. We just talked to them. We were there for an hour. Draper. We checked out the whole house. We know there's lots of doors there. There's lots of places to hide. I unlocked the back door, so it's all a lot. Now we just gotta wait and, yeah, we're a little bit nervous right now, but you know, we're ready. Adamczyk. We're listening to the greatest rock band anywhere for all time. Floyd. Draper. We've been waiting for this for a long time. Adamczyk. Before we commit the ultimate crime of murder. Now, at this point, they turn the camera off and put on black robes, white ghost-faced masks, and each pulls out a long, sharp knife. One had a serrated blade, the other had a smooth blade. And they really appeared to jump right out of the movie Scream. They snuck back into the Contreras house and let themselves into the basement quietly. When they got comfortable in the basement, they started to make a little bit of noise, trying to get Stoddard and Beckham to come downstairs. But all that happened was one of the dogs became suspicious and walked over to the top of the basement staircase. After several minutes of not being able to attract the two kids upstairs to come down, Draper and Adamczyk went to the circuit breaker and killed the power. That got Stoddard and Beckham's attention as the house was instantly pitch black. After a few moments, they turned the power back on, expecting that Stoddard and Beckham would then come down to the basement to try and figure out what was going on with the power. But again, they didn't come. Meanwhile, upstairs, it's now after 10 o'clock, and at the sudden unexpected loss of power, Stoddard became nervous. So Beckham called his mother. He told her that the power had flickered out for a little bit, and that Stoddard was anxious as a result. He asked for permission to stay the night there with her so she wouldn't be scared. Fortunately for him, his mother said no, and that she was coming to pick him up. She also told him that if Stoddard was really nervous about staying the night there, she could come back to their house, and she would be brought back in the morning to feed the animals and walk the dogs. But Stoddard felt that the house was her responsibility and declined the offer. A few minutes later, Beckham's mother arrived and picked him up. Stoddard was now alone in the house with Draper and Adamczyk in the basement, dressed all in black except for their ghost face masks, armed with hunting knives. Slowly, the two boys began to climb the stairs. They walk into the living room. They see where she's sitting, and all hell broke loose. Stoddard was stabbed 30 times in total, 12 of which were severe enough to be fatal. Her body was found Sunday when the Contreras family returned home. She was first discovered by her young cousin. After the stabbing, Draper and Adamczyk returned to Adamczyk's car. They took off the robes and the masks. They put them in the car's trunk along with their knives. They turned back on the video recorder and gleefully discussed watching the life drain out of Cassie Jo Stoddard. They talk about how there's no going back, and now they want to be spree killers with as high a body count as possible before they are taken down. These two 16-year-old boys who have just brutally executed someone who they consider to be a friend, all in the name of becoming infamous. After the murder, the boys drove to a secluded park called Black Rock Park. And there, they buried the robes, the masks, some bloody clothing, and the knives. They ejected their videotape, where they had discussed the planning and execution of this horrific act, and they tried to burn it with a box of matches that they had just recently purchased from a convenience store, but it wouldn't really light on fire. So, they buried it anyway, and went home. There was no spree. There was no high body count. Cassie Jo Stoddard's murder was nothing more than an act of senseless violence perpetrated by two disturbed and immature boys who completely and utterly lacked empathy or conscience. When Stoddard's body was discovered, immediately the investigation centered on Matt Beckham, who was assumed to be the last person to see her alive. He was interrogated and mentioned in passing that he wasn't the only person over at the Contreras home on September 22, 2006. Beckham tells the detectives that they had invited Adam Chick over to hang out and that he and Brian Draper had come for a little bit, but then had left to go to the movies. Beckham says he spoke on the phone with Adam Chick a little bit later that evening, after his mom had picked him up, but that Adam Chick had been whispering, and he believed that was due to them being in a movie theater. Let's take a quick moment, for those of you who don't deal with police investigations every day, to address how they're actually conducted. If you watch television shows or movies, you're inundated with the idea that Sherlock-esque investigators are able to observe an oddly colored hair on a suspect's jacket, or some discolored dirt on the side of his shoe, and make some profound connection to a crime scene or a significant piece of evidence. But let me disabuse you of that notion. That pretty much never happens. Good detective work does indeed consist of being observant, analyzing all the details discovered, regardless of whether they seem relevant at the time, because you never really know what might become important later, but it nearly always involves interviews and corroboration. Speaking to people, tracking down records or other materials to verify the truth of what people say is the cornerstone of detective work. Chances are, at some point, you've heard the old adage that good investigators match theories to facts rather than facts to theories. And what that means in plain English is that good detectives do not get tunnel vision. Rather than try to manipulate the facts that they obtain to match a theory they already have, they gather facts in an unbiased way and are constantly updating and tweaking their theories to align with the facts that they learn. Miscarriages of justice tend to occur when detectives ignore or disregard certain facts simply because they do not support a certain theory that they've decided to focus on before all the facts come in. Early on in this investigation, the detectives really didn't know where the facts would lead. This could have been a home invasion gone wrong. Someone may have known that the Contreras's were planning to be away for the weekend, thought it would be easy to break into the home and burglarize it, and were surprised to find Stoddard there, so they killed her to prevent her from reporting the crime. At first, that seemed like a really likely explanation for what happened. But the detectives were bothered by the fact that Stoddard was stabbed 30 times. That's not typically consistent with a home invader surprised by her presence, though it certainly is still possible. The detectives were searching for leads to suggest whether a home invasion took place. There were no broken windows, no forced locks, no door jams that were broken. Then Becca mentioned that Adam Chick and Draper were also present that night. So the investigators decided to interview those boys. There were multiple interviews, and for the sake of brevity, I will summarize how the interviews turned into interrogations and how they ultimately led to arrests. I'll also note that since both boys were 16 years old, they were always spoken to in the presence of a parent or parents, with both the boys and the parents indicating an understanding of the Miranda warnings. The first time each boy was spoken to, they gave a consistent story. They had gone to the Whispering Cliffs house, hung out for a bit, and had left to go to the movies. Then back to Adam Chick's house, where they spent the night. It seemed fairly reasonable. But, again, good police work is about corroboration. So the detectives asked them each what movie they went to see. And neither could recall the title. So the detectives then asked each what the plot of the movie was that they saw. And neither could remember that either. Now, this is significant and something we should mention. When detectives bring someone into an interrogation room, they mix questions with answers they know and questions with answers they don't know. Some of the questions they ask, they will already know the truth and be able to tell immediately if the interviewee is being honest. Sometimes they'll have a suspicion, but want to see if the person gives a credible answer. But if two boys being separately interviewed in connection to a brutal and grisly murder, both say they went to the movies together the night of the murder, which was only a couple days ago, and neither can provide a ticket stub, the name of the movie, or even the basic plot elements, it makes detectives think. Why would they lie about this? This is a lead. Investigators track down leads. It's what they do. They now know the boys are hiding something, but they don't know what. You don't want to jump to conclusions that it necessarily relates to this murder, but it's clear that they're being dishonest and the police needed to find out why. Here's a little insider information for you. I commend to your attention the specific technique of interviewing slash interrogation that was employed here. It is called the Reid technique, R-E-I-D. And detectives are trained in various methods of extracting information, but the Reid technique is very common. Here's how it works. It starts with what's called positive confrontation. You tell the person that the evidence collected thus far has led the police to believe that they are a suspect and offer them the opportunity to explain. Next, the detective, him or herself, will offer some justification or explanation of the crime that puts the suspect in a psychological state to actually discuss committing the crime in the context of being less responsible for it. The interrogator will try and frame the questions in a way to minimize the ability of the suspect to deny involvement. This often includes very slow and incremental offerings of fact, which the suspect is asked to agree with, and which tends to slowly show involvement. And typically, the law enforcement officer will continue to do this until the suspect offers some sort of reason why it simply couldn't have been them who committed the crime. Here is where it gets really psychologically interesting. The detective will then express belief that the suspect is being sincere and a willingness to listen and hear them out, but reiterate that they're only interested in honest answers. Once the suspect is finished responding with their explanation, the detective will offer two or sometimes three choices for the crime taking place, one being significantly more socially acceptable than the other or others. The goal is to try and goad the suspect into choosing the socially acceptable reason for them having committed the crime. And then when that happens, boom, guilt is admitted. Once the suspect actually says the words, then you repeat them in the form of questions over and over to reinforce their commitment to having done the act. Then have them build out the context about what happened and why. And that, dear listeners, is the Reid technique. So if you ever find yourself in a metal chair at a metal table with a one-way mirror on the wall and a single hanging light overhead, you'll be able to recognize the Reid technique and you'll know what's coming next. Once the detectives determined that Draper and Adamczyk had lied about going to the movies, they wanted to know what the boys were really doing. They circled back to each of them individually, Draper first. Initially, he tried to stick with the movie story, but ultimately he admitted that they had not gone to see a movie. Instead, he told the detectives that he and Adamczyk would sometimes go to residential neighborhoods at night and walk up and down the street testing car door handles to see if any of them were open so that they could steal things inside. This is a very common tactic used by criminals who think they can outsmart law enforcement. The idea is that the suspect first offers a completely benign explanation for their actions, such as, "We were just at the movies." Then, confronted with the knowledge that that's not true, the individual admits to some moderate criminal activity in an effort to convince the detective that they lied because they didn't want to admit to some minor criminal act, thinking law enforcement will believe this news story because now it's an admission against their own interest, so it should have some credibility. After all, who would admit to the cops that they were stealing from cars if they weren't really doing that? As a criminal defense lawyer, I see these types of statements way too often. I cannot tell you how many times a client has come to me with a DWI case, and I get the paperwork, and the cop who pulled my client over notes that the suspect said at the time of arrest, "I just had two drinks with dinner." They think that if they admit to just having two drinks, maybe they'll get off with a warning or a slap on the wrist, and that the cops will believe them because they have confided in the officer that they were in fact driving after having consumed alcohol. So they knew that what they were doing was wrong, but it was only a small amount of alcohol. So let's just agree not to go so hard on this one. The problem for Draper, just like many other suspects who tried this technique, was that the police simply didn't accept the story. They brought him a map and asked him to point out where they were. He couldn't identify the neighborhood. They offered to drive around with him personally until he recognized where they were so that they could dust some car door handles for fingerprints and get his fingerprints to verify that he was actually there. But he said he was wearing gloves. They asked him how long he and Adam Chick were doing this, and he said a long time. Then they said, okay, well, can you show us some of the stuff you stole so we can corroborate that that's what you were doing? And he said, in essence, that he didn't find a single car to get into. Now, at this point, the detectives began the read technique all over again. They told him that the evidence was showing that he was lying. They offered up some options related to the death of Stoddart that involved him. And eventually, Draper cracked. He told the detectives a story that was at least mostly true. He told them he had gone to the Whispering Cliffs house with Adam Chick. While there, Cassie had given them a tour and he had unlocked the back basement door. He told them that he and Adam Chick had left, and initially they had actually intended to kill a different schoolmate, but the opportunity didn't present itself, so they returned to the Contreras house quickly, where he and Adam Chick let themselves into the basement. There, they turned the breakers off and on to try and get Stoddart to come down and see what was happening, but she never came. They waited a long time while Beckham's mother picked him up, and then they came upstairs. Draper claimed that he was merely in the room. Adam Chick jumped on her and stabbed her to death. He then hinted that he was nervous Adam Chick would turn on him too if he didn't join in. He didn't say it outright, but the implication is unmistakable. After Stoddart's death, they returned to Adam Chick's car, took off their robes and masks, and went to a convenience store called Common Sense. Draper bought a box of matches. Then they went to Black Rock Park, a secluded area not too far away, where they found a place a little away from the road. They previously put a shovel from Draper's house in the trunk of the car. At Black Rock Park, they attempted to burn the videotape they made from before and after the murder. They buried the knives used, the mask, the robes, and some bloody clothing. Draper showed the detectives exactly where everything was buried. Detectives also obtained surveillance footage from Common Sense showing the boys there that late Friday night on September 22, 2006. Draper was then taken into custody. Armed with all of this, they went back to Adam Chick and interviewed him again. And he also tried to push the movie story again at first. And when he was told the detectives knew for a fact he wasn't at the movies, he also brought up the car burglary story. Clearly, the two had discussed what to tell police if they were questioned and the movie alibi fell through. Adam Chick gave a very similar story. He and Draper were walking down residential neighborhoods, testing car doors to see if they could steal anything. Even knowing full well that this was not true, the detectives gave Adam Chick plenty of rope to hang himself. They asked him the same questions they asked Draper. What neighborhood was it? Could you show us on a map where you were? How long were you there? Can you show us some of the stuff you stole? If we dust these cars for prints, will we find yours on any of them to really prove you were there? As you can imagine, Adam Chick tried to dodge his way out of each and every question. And finally, the detectives had had enough. They tell Adam Chick that they know what actually happened. First, they tell him they have the footage of him and Draper at Common Sense. Adam Chick tries to explain that by saying that he forgot that they stopped there because Draper needed matches, because he smokes. So the detectives ask what brand of cigarettes Draper smokes. Adam Chick does not know. Later, Draper denied that he smokes cigarettes regularly. He has them occasionally, but he does not have a preferred brand. The detectives then tell Adam Chick that a witness, a resting truck driver, spotted their car at Black Rock Park. Adam says, oh, that's where Draper wanted to go to smoke his cigarettes. Next, the detective said they knew that Adam Chick's car had a shovel in the trunk. Why did he have a shovel? Adam Chick responded that he and Draper were building a vert ramp for skateboarding and rollerblading behind his house. The detectives asked if they could test the soil on the shovel to see if it matched the soil behind his house. Adam Chick got very quiet at that point. Then the detectives finally told him that that Draper had confessed, that they had found the videotape, the knives, the masks, the robes, the bloody clothing. They told Adam Chick they knew that he stabbed Stoddard and that he was going to be placed under arrest. And it's at this point that Adam Chick finally tells the officers that he wants a lawyer. I spoke to a few friends about this case as I was doing the research and writing it up. And as I walked through just how damning these interrogations were, a couple people brought up a very valid issue, which is worth discussing. Adam Chick and Draper both had their parents in the room for the entirety of their interrogations, multiple different times, hours and hours. Why did they agree to it? Why didn't they demand a lawyer and walk out? Without Draper's confession, it's very unlikely the detectives would ever have discovered the buried tape, the knives, the masks, the clothes. They would have no statement admitting to the killing, no murder weapon, no motive. So the question out there is, why did anyone agree to participate in these interrogations, and why didn't anyone cut them far shorter than they were? I'll offer you my personal opinion on the matter. Some of you will doubtless disagree with me, and I'm sure you'll let me know why. But here goes. Bannock County, Idaho, is again the sixth most populous county in a state with a relatively small population. This is a rural community. It's not New York, Chicago, whatever. People in communities like this trust law enforcement and don't walk into meetings with them skeptical. Now add to that that the parents of these kids could not possibly believe or comprehend that their 16-year-old sons could be so morally depraved as to slaughter a 16-year-old classmate that they were friends with, a girl who Adam Chick's family had met and had over to their house several times. The parents here must have believed that their kids had reasonable explanations for where they were and that be able to tell the police what they were doing and cross themselves off the suspect list. I'm imagining that they never even considered the possibility that speaking to the police might result in their kids getting arrested. And then once all the lies had been broken down and the truth had come out, you can see in the interrogation videos that the parents are completely unable to process what they're hearing. Brian Draper had both parents in the room. Adam Chick's father was present when the detectives explained what they knew he did. I think the parents were just too in shock to have the presence of mind to demand a lawyer and cease questioning. It's certainly not what they were expecting when they brought their sons in to speak. And I think a 16-year-old boy is going to be way too scared and naive to assert that right on his own. Again, that's just my opinion. But it's the best reason I can come up with for why these interrogations were allowed to continue for hours and hours and on so many different days until Draper finally broke down and Adam Chick's entire story completely disintegrated. Draper and Adam Chick were both charged with first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder in the first degree. Then something very interesting took place. The two defendants were severed, meaning the cases would go to trial separately. Draper's case went to trial first, then Adam Chick's went to trial a little bit later. Most of the time, when multiple people are arrested for committing the same crime, they're tried together. Both defendants and their defense attorneys sit at the same table. They may have separate defenses, they may even blame each other, but there is just one trial. This is done because it's generally considered a huge waste of time and resources to try one defendant and then put on what is essentially the exact same trial for the second defendant, when the same witnesses, the same facts, the same arguments, and the same proof are all involved. It's also a little unfair to the first defendant because the second defendant has the opportunity to use all the testimony from the first trial for cross-examination. So there's a significant push to try co-defendant cases together. I was able to get my hands on some of the case documents, but I was not able to get the motion which severed the cases. That being said, I think I know why the judge in this case, the Honorable Peter McDermott, granted severance. There is a rule, it's called the Bruton Rule, B-R-U-T-O-N, which most lawyers don't even know about because it is so rarely relevant. It deals with situations when a judge is mandated to sever criminal defendant cases. And the rule is, if one defendant's confrontation clause rights are violated because of evidence introduced against a co-defendant, then the two defendants cannot be tried together. Let's break that down in plain English. The prosecutor, Mark Heidemann, has interrogations from both Draper and Adamczyk, which he wants to play for the jury. In Draper's interrogation, he confesses to the crime itself, putting pretty much all of the actual blame on Adamczyk. If the two are tried together, Heidemann cannot force Draper to testify because he has a Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. So Draper's confession would be admissible against Draper, as it is a statement against his own penal interest, and is therefore not hearsay. But it is inadmissible against Adamczyk, because in that case, it is hearsay. Draper's confession is an out-of-court statement being offered in the trial for the truth of the contents of the statement. Essentially, Heidemann wants to introduce the confession as evidence of what really happened that night. But if Draper and Adamczyk are tied together, that statement cannot be admitted into evidence because Adamczyk's lawyers would not have an opportunity to cross-examine the person who made the statement, Draper, due to his Fifth Amendment right. So Judge McDermott had no choice but to try each separately. Draper's confession could be admitted against Draper, and Adamczyk's interrogation could be admitted against Adamczyk, but they could not use the other defendant's admissions or interrogations against each other. Draper went to trial first in April of 2007. He was represented by a man named Randy Schultes. Heidemann's case, while fairly gory and Hollywood-esque, was fairly straightforward. The trial itself only took 6 days. Heidemann had the videotapes of the boys talking about killing Cassie and Matt Beckham prior to the murder, and the video of them talking about what they had done directly after it happened, playing for the jury the clips where Draper and Adamczyk discussed watching the life drain out of Stoddart's body. They had the knives, the masks, the robes, the bloody clothing, and the shovel used to bury them all. They had the matchbook bought at Common Sense used to try and burn the tape before putting it in the earth. And then they had the forensics. Two different forensic pathologists testified for the prosecution about Stoddart's body. The first testified that of the 30 stab wounds, it is clear that at least two different knives were used. One had a serrated edge and one did not. The other testified that Stoddart's DNA was found on the serrated blade. The second pathologist testified that the wounds on the back were likely inflicted first due to the amount of bleeding from them and were most likely the fatal wounds, which explains the lack of defensive wounds. Heidemann also called a forensic scientist to discuss other DNA tests that were performed. Stoddart's DNA was not only found on the serrated knife, but also one of the masks and some of the clothing. And Schultes did the best he could with the hand he was dealt. He argued preliminarily that Adamczyk had done the stabbing. Draper was merely in the room. He argued that all of the forensic evidence which had blood on it, the serrated knife, the clothing, the bloody mask, those all belonged to Adamczyk, and Draper's items didn't have any blood because he really didn't participate. But the evidence was simply overwhelming, and Draper was convicted of both the murder and conspiracy after very short deliberation. Approximately 2 months later, Tori Adamczyk went to trial. His defense team, led by Aaron Thompson, painted a different picture than Schultes did for Draper. Thompson's defense was that it was Draper who masterminded the whole thing. Adamczyk had believed they were dressed up like the Ghostface killer from Scream just to scare Stoddart. Draper had been pushing them to go to the living room, and when he didn't want to, Draper pushed past him and rushed Stoddart. Adamczyk's story was that he saw Draper stabbing her with the serrated knife, and he fled back to the car, where Draper turned the videotape back on, and then told the camera that he had just killed Cassie and saw her lifeless body. Heidemann presented the same evidence in Adamczyk's case, except for the different videotaped interrogations. The forensics were again devastating. At one point, a defense expert, Rudolf Riet, testified that he had conducted tests on a pig belly using similar knives, but that the defense was denied access to the actual knives in evidence. Now, this prompted Heidemann to jump out of his seat and call Riet a liar in front of the jury. And McDermott had choice words for both parties at this point and dismissed the jury temporarily. In the end, Riet was given access to the knives and resumed his testimony. Adamczyk was convicted of murder in the first degree and conspiracy. Both Adamczyk and Draper were initially sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. But that sentence was abrogated by a 2012 Supreme Court case, which determined that it was cruel and unusual punishment to sentence an individual under the age of 18 to life without parole. So their sentences were both amended to 30 years to life, meaning they will have to serve a minimum of 30 years before they become eligible for parole, and then will have to convince a parole board to let them out, which may not be so easy for them. In summation, there's a lot to take away from this case. I'll be the first defense attorney to tell you that sometimes you get a case with a strong defense, and sometimes you get one where the evidence is truly stacked against you. This case was tough for Thompson and Schultes. Self-recorded videotape, the interrogation tapes, the forensic evidence found at Black Rock Park, the surveillance of them buying matches even, specifically to try and burn the tape and destroy the evidence, it all looked bad. So what did the defense lawyers do? They tried to make the other defendant the more guilty party. But under acting in concert theories of prosecution, if Draper wanted to say Adamczyk actually did the stabbing, but he's also in the house holding a knife with a ghost face scream mask after having broken in through the basement and being on camera discussing how they were about to kill their friend Cassie, just being in the room is still going to be more than enough for a jury to convict. Based on the testimony of the pathologist that two knives were clearly used, I don't think it's likely the jury bought either boy's story, that it was the other guy who did the actual stabbing. But even if they did, they'd both still be guilty. What these two boys did was absolutely horrific. It can cause a knot to form in your stomach, hearing about how little they valued the life of one of their friends. There's a question that criminal defense lawyers get asked a lot. I wouldn't be surprised if Schultes and Thompson got it after these trials. I was asked it over and over again after the Chapo trial. How do you defend people who do such horrific things? How can you represent someone who's been responsible for mass murder, or a violent rape, or terrorism? It's a valid question. I typically begin to answer by asking whether a person who's starving and steals a small amount of food deserves someone who's willing to zealously fight for their rights. I have yet to meet anyone who opposes that concept. Most people respond that we're discussing two completely separate cases here. But for myself, my colleagues, and the attorneys in the criminal defense community, there is literally no difference between defending a Brian Draper, an Al Chapo, a Ted Bundy, or a guy who shoplifts a candy bar from a bodega when it comes to how we view our job. Defending someone who's charged with unspeakable acts of terror or unfeeling brutality in no way means that their advocate condones such activities. Far from it. However, the fact remains that to be an effective criminal defense attorney, it is absolutely essential that one separate the acts their client is accused of committing from their determination to defend a client's constitutional rights to the fullest extent permitted by law. The moment that we start making distinctions, when we start to say that one client deserves our full efforts because he or she is sympathetic, while another is a societal pariah and therefore less entitled to our best efforts, that's the moment we have failed to live up to our oath and to our mandate The world is full of examples of countries where a governmental accusation is sufficient to jail someone for life. The beauty of the American system is the government has to actually prove the defendant actually committed the crime before they can be punished, regardless if it's Charles Manson or somebody who jumped a subway turnstile to get on a train without pay. Nobody deserves to be put in prison without the government establishing conclusively that the individual is guilty of a crime. Sir William Blackstone, one of the founders of the British legal system that we base the American system off of, is famously quoted as saying it would be better to let 10 guilty persons go free than to convict a single innocent man. As defense attorneys, it is our job to force the government to prove their case, to test the credibility and the veracity of their evidence, and ensure that no individual is deprived of due process, which is their right, even if they're charged with genocide. People accused of a crime rightfully expect that, regardless of the charges, their lawyers are going to fight for them. And it's an honor and a privilege to do so, because defending the person is really defending the system of rights and of checks and balances. It is not excusing or downplaying bad behavior. It is ensuring that even those accused of truly heinous acts get the same treatment that we extend to everyone else. Only then are we entitled to be proud of our system. Brian Draper and Tori Adamczyk have the same rights as any other criminal defendant. They don't abandon them just because their actions were especially stomach-churning. So that's the show. Slasher movie murder, the Reid technique for interrogations, Rudin issues, and the calling to defend indefensible actions. A special thank you to Dan Townsend, who edited today's episode and provided the background. If you want to get in touch with me to suggest a topic or a case, if you want to ask a question about criminal law, or if you just want to send me a message, please email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod. I'm on Instagram at insummation. You can visit the show's website, insummation.com. Check out the Facebook page or look me up in my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. I am now even on TikTok answering some questions I get about criminal law and procedure. As always, I appreciate the thoughtful messages I get and the discussions that they tend to generate. And if you disagree with me, you're always free to let me know what you think and why, and maybe you'll even change my mind. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show. And if you rate and review it, it'll help other people find it as well. As always, thanks for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more.